This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 32 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Max, we have two guests joining us this episode who are going to talk about how they use small UASs in their business and how they use it and help kids with autism. So let's introduce our guests, huh, Max?
Absolutely. First, we have Paul Braun. He's the Vice President of Sales and Marketing with Continental Mapping Consultants, Inc. Now, Paul's been in the geospatial industry since the late 80s, working for federal clients, education, doing some consulting, mapping and surveying, a whole variety of things. And as we'll see, this being important, he's the father of three boys, one of whom has autism. So, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Max and David. It's good to be here.
Now, we're going to have a really interesting conversation about some of the things you guys are doing, but we need to introduce also Dan Fry. He's also with Continental Mapping Consultants, and he's the Federal Market Program Manager. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show. And what's your background in this industry?
Thanks for having me. I've been in the geospatial industry for about the same amount of time as Paul, working for a couple different companies over the years, but mostly in the federal market.
Okay, for us non-lingo geeks, when do you want to tell us what the geospatial market is?
Yeah, sure. So the industry is comprised of everything from data developers like ourselves, so the mapping and surveying component, all the way through to end users that leverage that data for and mapping for everything from environmental management to social issues to managing infrastructure, sewer, water, utilities, etc. So it's the whole industry that develops, builds, and uses all that mapping content. You know, these days we think of Google Earth and Bing Maps and things like that, very ubiquitous services. And we're the kind of guys behind the scenes who build a lot of that stuff.
Why don't we start off with what is ASD or autism spectrum disorders that got you started in this?
Yeah, I'd be happy to take that. Thanks, David. The ASD is really a spectrum of disorders. At their roots, they're social and communication oriented. You know, there's the CDC estimates approximately 1 in 88 people now have some semblance of ASD or autism. We like to say that you take two people with autism and they're going to be very different. You know, an appendicitis is an appendicitis, but autism is a spectrum in that there's a lot of differences. You know, some of the issues we see there, you look at social skills. So the social and communication problems make it very difficult for people to integrate into the workforce, whether it's in school or out in employment as they're adults. So dealing with all the nuance that we do every day in terms of interacting with our mate, our friends, our colleagues, really can be difficult for people with autism-related disorders. So, you know, even to the effect of recent studies show that somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of young adults with autism are unemployed. So the numbers are astronomical. They're way over other populations of disabilities, such as Down syndrome or cerebral palsy and things like that. So, and it's mostly because people struggle to stay employed. So there's a lot of issues there that, you know, with early diagnosis and treatment and therapy and so forth that help give these kids and eventually adults the ability to integrate in society, to hold jobs, to be productive, to pay taxes and the whole thing. So my wife and I have gotten a PhD in autism, so to speak, over the last 10 years or so. But, you know, it's a really growing phenomenon. It's very prevalent and it has a real impact on society.
Now, the reason we have Paul and Dan on the UAV Digest is that they've been involved in a project called Taking Autism to the Sky, or TATTS, which I guess you guys shorten to be TATS.
Yes, we do.
So tell our listeners what TATS is all about.
So the TATS project was really oriented to leverage the strengths of people with autism and to help address their weaknesses. So their strengths being things like they tend to be very visual thinkers. So you look at someone like Temple Grandin, who's a popular presenter, a woman with autism. She talks about how she thinks in pictures, very visual. She has a Google Images in her brain, she says. So thinking about how kids like that can be very visual, and they have the ability to often attend to detail and have deep focus. So we think about, hey, they've got these capabilities. How do we leverage that and bring that into the world of UAV? So as professionals and working with that technology, I looked at my son, Mitchell, and saw the possibility of bringing these two together. And really it was to give concrete thinkers a very different way of perspective taking. And that was to bring a UAS into the air using video, real time, and first person viewing and so forth, and give these kids a very pragmatic feeling of what it means to be someone else. But we also wanted to step away and evaluate this emerging market as an employment opportunity. So we felt these kids have unique skills. They are often struggle in the employment world. And we've got an emerging market that's very high tech, that has tons of opportunity for employment. How do we find a sweet spot in there that could really leverage their strengths and help them work on their weaknesses?
It's a really brilliant application of UAVs to something that's socially important. Now, Dan, wasn't this originally funded through a Kickstarter campaign?
It was, yeah. I can remember when Paul and I were at having dinner in D.C. on a trip, and he came to me with the tell me his idea and said he wanted to do it on Kickstarter. And I was like, man, that is an awesome idea to way to fund that. And he gave me his plan and wanted me to think about it a little bit. And I said right away, I said, well, I'm in, you know, you can put me down on that. And then I asked him if there's anything I could do to help. You know, is there any work around the edges that he needed? And he told me what his opening plan was, or what his goal was for raising funds. And I said, Paul, I said, I think you can shoot a little higher than that. I don't remember what the exact numbers were, but I kind of tried to encourage him to ask for a little bit more to see if he could get a little bit more equipment or a little bit better equipment. And it went really well. I don't remember, Paul, what were the, how many donors did you get? Do you remember?
Yeah, we had just shy of 80 donors total from all over the world. We raised $3,600, give or take. $2,600 was the goal that Dan talked me into. I think I was around $1,500 originally. But, you know, with a Kickstarter model of crowdsourcing of financials like that, it's all or nothing. So if you don't meet your goal, nobody pays. So, you know, they don't want you getting greedy and asking for tons of money, and then you only get a portion. So you have to think that through a lot. So we did a lot of research on equipment, and you know, this was all about the real-time experience, much like the videography people in the UAS space. You know, we really wanted that, so we needed goggles and real-time video and all of that. So we really wanted to think through the parts and have the financials to back it, and you know, buy a few pizzas along the way and have some fun too.
So let's talk about the equipment and how the kids interact with it. It's a hexacopter, I believe.
Correct. We got a DJI F550 hex rotor, and it comes completely unassembled. So the kids were responsible for putting that together with a lot of supervision, of course. You know, there's soldering going on and ensuring that, you know, all the bolts were sufficiently tightened and Loctite on all the threads so that nothing would come apart during flight. We're using a Spectrum radio. We got some Fat Shark goggles to give the first person view. Those are the big major parts that we use. We do have a full laundry list of what exactly all the parts were if somebody else wanted to reproduce what we've done here up on the up on the website if anybody wanted to take a look at that.
Had you and Paul been flying already, or was this something that you had to learn as well?
We had to learn it.
Tell the truth, Dan.
I had some experience years and years ago with RC gliders and airplanes and a couple of helicopters, but it was still a learning curve because I'd forgotten most of what I had learned. So it was. I tell you though, I was impressed with how quickly Paul picked it up. I was expecting a lot of crashes and a lot of broken parts to begin with, but he did a good job of minimizing that.
How quick do the kids pick it up?
That was actually surprised me. I don't have children of my own, so I don't interact with kids, you know, on a daily basis. So I was expecting them to be not very comfortable with it at all. But we started out with a simulator on the computer to give them a sense of control. And right away, we could see which kids were heavy on the stick, which kids had a better feel for, you know, the touch that was needed. We also discovered right away that the kids love nothing more in the simulator than crashing the airplane and doing that over and over and over again. So that was a challenge right there. We also had a few small little cheap indoor helicopters that they could fly off the counters in the house while we were waiting for the spring to roll in. That got them a little bit more experience and a little bit better feel for what was going on. And then when we took them out into the field and put them in control with the added technology that is on the UAS with the GPS and stabilizers and those kinds of things, they did remarkably well flying the UAS. It was really quite impressive.
And what age group were these kids? Did you say that before?
I did not. They are the youngest was 7 at the time, up through 14, all boys. That's just kind of how it played out. We had my other two sons, Harrison and Torin, also participated. We had several other siblings, too. So the requirement was that a parent had to come in. This was not a drop your kid off at Paul's house and we're going to go take them flying kind of situation. So the parents were involved. They facilitated stations as the kids worked their way through different things. So we had 11 or 12 kids with, you know, one or two missing on every occasionally, that sort of thing. But it was a good dozen total.
Hmm. What I guess the question is, what are you using as metrics as a baseline to show improvement, to show that the activity is working?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if I was to start over, my wife tells me we would bring in an autism specialist to really get specific, and that sort of factors into some of our future goals. But we did some pretty concrete things, certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of excitement, a lot of, you know, holy cows, you know, that kind of stuff. But one of the most prominent was we did some before and after renderings. So we would talk to the kids, hey, what do you think a bird sees when they fly above this open wetland park that we're in? And then we'd fly, and then we'd have them draw new drawings. And across the board, the drawings would be very different after the fact. There'd be horizon lines, there'd be roads and buildings, and a very clear difference in what they could see before as opposed to after.
And that was kind of what you were trying to achieve in large part, wasn't it? To show these kids with autism that there are different perspectives and different ways to look at the same thing.
Absolutely. Because that, as visual thinkers and people who struggle with non-literal language, we wanted to give them a concrete example so they could literally go in the air and look at themselves, look at the playground, look at the park, and literally see it from a different perspective. And that really helped resonate with them. But yet there were things like the teamwork, you know, turn-taking and sort of rudimentary social skills that we take for granted in our workplace and with our families, that we worked a lot on that because it's hard to wait until it's your turn to fly. The kids step back. My son tells me now that he's famous because, you know, things like this. And there's a subtle message there about kids on the spectrum and adults on the spectrum who have struggled and have a lot of self-esteem problems. You know, my son feels very different about himself. And to me, that's worth a fortune. And I think a lot of the other kids would feel that way too. They kind of have a, Well, I keynoted at a GIS conference about this, and we had the kids stand up, and they got a round of applause, and man, I never saw so many smiles in my whole life.
Oh,
so,
boy, I bet.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, too. And now, you know, looking at next steps, where do we go with it? How do we expand it? You know, getting these kids opportunities to go out and talk about what they've done and take it to the next level. So that's kind of some of what we're kicking around right now.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. Yeah, is a next step. Do you bring more kids through a program like this, or do you stick with, as it were, the kids that you've got already and kind of take some next development steps in that regard? What are your thoughts?
We've talked about a variety of things. One is we've been contacted by folks all over the country about the possibility of just doing it on their own with a small group. It's a little bit of a you know, you can read our blog, but there's no instructions for me to hand someone. So there's, you're sort of on your own a little bit, but we've talked about a deeper focus with the current kids, maybe getting other UASs, different platforms, doing more with video editing, getting into, you know, nadir photography and doing actual point cloud development and mapping and so on. We're looking for expanding more formally. You look at like the STEM education movement, and can we look at some sort of a curriculum that could be handed out to middle schools all over the country? Because there's Lego clubs, there's science clubs. It's like, why can't we do this? Because there's so many programs now at the tech college level, you know, starting to do UAV certifications and things like that. It's like, well, let's start them earlier. These kids are so focused on gaming and technology. They're visual thinkers. They're concrete thinkers. They have attention to detail. We got a ripe audience here of future employees.
Yeah, Paul, as you mentioned STEM, we saw an article in the Dayton Daily News titled Students Using Drones to Learn High-Tech Jobs. And it's kind of an interesting story because here we see students at Greenan High School in Ohio that they are preparing students using UAS software, simulation software from Analytical Graphics, actually, for modeling and computer simulation. It's part of a STEM project that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And it's they're using actually simulating UAVs that could monitor natural disasters or be used in a military crisis, that sort of a thing, with these high school students. And it represents really a terrific educational and developmental opportunity. So it's really great to see people like those folks in Ohio there, folks like yourselves, you know, using this technology with younger folks to achieve things that could have been fairly difficult to achieve in the past.
Yeah. The social applications of UAS, people talk a lot about that in conservation, environmental management, and so on. What's unique here is that we're actually applying social sciences to this. So the idea of social skill development, you know, it's a sort of a subcomponent of that broader environmental applications and things. So really using it to develop social capabilities in people, which is, it's sort of puts the whole thing on its head a little bit that way, which I think really, you know, we're proud of that because it's a sort of a unique angle, I guess.
Very good.
So I guess we should talk a little bit about how you fund this organization by your day jobs. Dan, you want to talk a little bit about mapping with UAVs?
Yeah, sure. We, as a geospatial data production company, we gather or we collect our data from a number of different sources. It might be airplanes taking air photos or aerial LIDAR. It might be mobile LIDAR or terrestrial LIDAR. It could be a helicopter as well, or satellite. We do a lot with that as well, satellite imagery. So we see this as just another possible sensor, another possible platform, I guess, for us to get the kind of data that we need to work in our air, in our field. Paul, you want to expand on that?
Well, we always say the phone rings at our company because somebody has data that's not current enough, it's not clear enough, or is lacking in clarity, or it's lacking in content. So now with a UAS, I can go places faster, more often, to get, you know, I can solve the currency problem, or I can go back every day and get a lot of data. I fly lower, so I get more detail, and I can extract things out. Like, you know, we've used in the project here, the PIX4D folks have been kind enough to allow us to use their software for free. So, you know, these kids are generating 3D point clouds from this imagery and moving into true 3D modeling. And that, in terms of content, you know, that's what engineers want today is true 3D data. That's what their end customers are requiring for 3D design. So it's a real, it just makes good sense. And if we can do it faster, cheaper, better, you know, it gives us sort of another arrow in the quiver. But, you know, we also talk about, it's about the data, right? I mean, we can get lots of different UASs, different platforms. We can hang all sorts of sensors on them, whether it's visible light, near infrared, thermal, you name it. But the platform allows us to collect tons of data. And it costs a lot of money to put an airplane in the air right now. So we're really saying our goal and our role is to use our skills in developing data from that imagery, from that LiDAR data, to give it to somebody to do design work, to do analysis, whatever. So we just see this proliferation of data coming that really will leverage our strengths. So it's a real exciting opportunity, whether it's above the ground, on the ground, or below the ground, because a lot of the UAS world is tied closely to terrestrial, you know, autonomous stuff and water-based, you know, all that stuff. Our often has to map in 3D above, on, and below the ground now. So it's kind of where the market's at.
So I guess, Max, we should ask the old question you get in the interview. So where do you guys see TATS 5 years from now?
It's like Rocky. It'll be TATS 5, right?
No, let's not hope it goes down. Now, remember, you're talking to someone from Philadelphia. Be careful what you say here.
Oh, sorry. I was like, cue the music, Max.
Right, you know, Rocky 1 was great. They went downhill after that.
Yeah.
You know, my dream is a nonprofit, and there's good precedent for this. Nonprofit businesses fully run by people on the autism spectrum. And that is the holy grail in the autism community right now, is employment. And so I want my kid to be the CEO of a company and not to set his sights low because of a disability. I'd love a nonprofit out there that has the authority and through a new regulatory environment that can do this and make a living and provide real value to businesses, to environmental organizations, to homeowners, to real estate agents, insurance agents, all the way down the line. There's real potential there. It's just we need to turn that into a sustainable model. And you know, the regulatory framework is certainly one aspect of that.
And I think to expand on what Paul said, from my perspective, and the role I played on this project, or I am playing on this project, is the exposure that I got and am getting to these kids and the people on the autism spectrum. I had never had the opportunity before to interact with kids on the spectrum. And so it was a learning experience for me. And what I took away from this, I think I got more out of this than anybody else on the project, because I was able to see these kids excel at something, watch them grow a little bit during the time of this project. I got to witness the parents of these kids, who are the most patient people I've ever seen. Just, you know, because there'd be times when things would get a little crazy with, you know, there'd be some disagreements between the kids, or some kids would get frustrated with something maybe, and you see the stereotypical parent in the grocery store that is mad at their kid because the kid picked up a box of Fruit Loops or something. And you know, there was nothing of that with any of these parents. It was all very calm, you know, go, you know, hug the kid and calm him down and make sure everybody's good. And I learned so much working with Paul and the rest of these people that if with a program like this, if it can expand into other areas and more people, and gives other people like me the opportunity to work with these kids and people on the autism spectrum, it'll allow them to have much more success finding employment and retaining employment in the future.
Hmm. Dan, that's a really, really interesting point. And I think a really important one as well. I think it's sort of human nature that when we don't understand something or someone or, you know, whatever it is, when we just don't understand, then we almost subconsciously fall back on prejudices or assumptions or all kinds of things that are probably wrong. And that, you know, when you have an opportunity to be exposed and engaged in something like you were, yeah, the power of getting that good, healthy perspective is just amazing.
It is. It really is. And that's precisely why I wanted to be involved in the project, because it was something that was, you know, for lack of a better term, outside my comfort zone, and it really worked out well.
Sure. So tell our listeners where they can find out more about this program, Taking Autism to the Sky.
Yeah, so we have a project blog that we have been real careful to keep updated. Partially, we wanted all of our financiers to be aware of what we're up to and how we're spending their money, but also to leave sort of a paper trail of how it can be done. So we have a blog. It's www.takingautismtothesky.blogspot.com.
All right, great. We'll put that in the show notes for sure. And on that site, I know that there are some great videos of the kids and the multicopters flying, and there's some great stuff like that there.
Yeah, we worked hard to. We built out a YouTube channel and loaded up a lot of video content, because that's where all the fun is. Still shots are great, but we wanted to have the video. And one of the deliverables was that the kids were going to build their own videos from all the composite content. So the university here in the Landscape Architecture Department gave us access to their lab before school started in the fall. Kids came in and we had a slam session and built out video. So the kids have compiled their own content, and that, if you watch those, you really see what they cared about. It was the crashes made it in everybody's video.
Yes.
It cost me like $150 too to repair the parts, but they thought it was cool. But they picked out the things that caught their eye, and it gives you a little bit of an insight into what they found entertaining and enlightening and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff out there. We wanted to show people what we're building. And I've just recently posted some of the point clouds that we've been building with Pix4D. So we're starting to kind of transition into that as well. And with spring coming, we'll probably be adding more, I suppose.
All right, and then maybe finally a question, and this might be kind of difficult to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. For those of our listeners who are impressed with what you guys are doing, do you have anything that you would like them to do or recommend that they do, either to support the Taking Autism to the Sky project that you guys are involved in or other things that they might do?
Well, certainly... I think any support via email is something we show to the kids to kind of get a sense like, hey, people out there are aware of you and they think it's interesting. That's sort of a moral support. We are submitting on the Social Innovation Award or the grant contest through the Drone User Group. I don't know if there's voting for that, Max, but certainly putting in a good word for us. So, you know, I know there's a cash prize there. We'd love to get in the running for that, but... We may go out for another round of funding, too. There might be opportunity there. If people are so inclined, we'd be honored to take those any kind of financial donation and put it to good use.
All right. Very good. David, what do you think?
This is one of those episodes where I'm a bit speechless because it's just really cool. And, Dan, you almost had me bawling my eyes out. From the moment I got your email, it definitely, I forwarded it over to Max going, this is awesome. Let's get them on.
Yeah, no question.
And if we can do a little bit by sharing with you what you guys are doing with our audience, because if you've listened to enough of my shows, they know that my biggest pet peeve is the word drone is associated with a predator or a reaper carrying hellfires. And this is the absolute opposite, where it's for fantastic good. And congratulations to you both, and more to the point, congratulations to your kids. And if there's something we can do, Max and I, in the future to help, even if you come back with an update, you know, and we've had another crash, but we got great video of it. we would definitely appreciate it.
All right, David, what do you think? Should we wrap this up?
Yeah, folks, we do have a lot of listener mail, so maybe next week we'll do a listener mail episode, and we probably will be talking about automated underwater vehicles, or AUVs, given the nature of the news today. So,
all right, so you've been listening to episode 32 of the UAV Digest. Be sure to find our show notes at theuavdigest.com. Or you can use the shortcut to go right to this episode. That's theuavdigest.com/32 for episode 32. We'd really like to thank our guests for joining us, Paul Braun and Dan Fry. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter at UAV Digest. We also have a Facebook page, UAV Digest. And if you want to send us an email, that address is feedback@theuavdigest.com. All right, David, I think that's it.
That's it. So until next week, this is David in Philly.
And this is Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.